I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Today on What's Next, a return to Olean and the Center for African American Cultural Development. During an earlier episode, we met with the founder, Della Moore, who made us promise to come back to take the typically self-guided walking tour of African American history of Olean. On this day of 10,000 steps, though, Della Moore leads myself and digital editor Dallas Taylor through her city and its history.
We're going right down the street. We're going down Hamilton Street.
Okay.
Up to North Union Street.
Mm-hmm. And the tour starts with recalling a legendary citizen, Sarah Johnson, who escaped slavery and made Olean her home for decades.
Oh. Sarah Johnson was quote unquote discovered.
Gotcha.
You know, when they saw her first, she was half naked. She cloth on her feet. Mm. She had come a long way from Maryland, all the way from Maryland. And and I had the numbers down for a second, how long that was.
Sure.
But how far that was. But in order to run away and in the dark, not knowing where you're going, except that you are paying attention to that North Star. And she said, when it was cloudy, she followed the geese, where the geese were going. Yep, yep, yes, yes, yes. And to do that, and that took a lot of courage. That took a lot of determination. That took a lot of hunger for freedom. My gosh, not knowing. She's about 13 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I get lost in Allegheny. You know, walking. I mean, at night mostly. Yeah. You know, all the time at night, you know, and hiding during the day where she could, you know, behind the barns and in fields and stuff like that, you know, alone and not knowing who to trust, et cetera. Yeah, yeah. That took a lot of courage.
You know. As I know you told the story of Sarah Johnson probably thousands of times.
That's all right. I never
but
tire
as you're,
of it.
As you're telling me here, standing here, I got chills.
Oh, no, look at Goosebumps.
Yep. You do too.
Yes,
even
always.
After all these times.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that
yes,
kind of
yes.
Meaning to you.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. And the fact that she made it, you know, and she was not the only one. Of course, as we know, the story of the Underground Railroad, there are tons of people who have helped, and tons of people in different races and different groups, different religions have helped, you know, and we couldn't do it without them.
Yeah.
We couldn't do it without them. Sarah Johnson herself says that she got a ride from the 2 mile road, which is a part of the creek, the Allegheny River, down here, by a young girl in a canoe. This town is awesome.
So basically, I know you told me that the story of Sarah when we were here the last time, but basically, Olean protected her and others.
Oh yes, yes,
from
yes.
Being taken back to the South.
Yes, yes, and that was a very real threat, you know, because they had patios, all over it. And because people wanted, down south, wanted their property back, because that was their bread and butter, you know. And, there were bounty hunters going throughout the north trying to find it. They'd even grab free blacks and take them back down south. But, yeah. But Olean, no, there was not one former enslaved person captured and sent back to down south in Olean. Not one. Not one. In all the time, the terrible times of the Civil War, not one. You know, and the runaway, not one. Everybody who came here was safe here. Was safe here. And and that says a lot about Olean.
You're proud
that's
of it.
That says a lot about, am I ever. Yep. Am I ever. God bless you. So we have, we're going up to the Olean House, which was the Martin's Inn back in the day.
Okay.
Judge Martin. He had an inn with stables and stuff, and it was wooden like most of the places, you know, and all. And he wouldn't, well, there's a story about Judge Martin. For one thing, there were some enslaved people who ran away, and they were in the back of the Olean House, the Judge Martin's Inn, and they were eating. And the bounty hunters came and looking for them, you know, looking for anybody, you know, like that. And Judge Martin wouldn't let them in. And in fact, he said that he sent them on a way that wasn't the right way, you know, be it buffalo or whatever. And when the bounty hunters realized that they've been tricked, they came back. Now, take in consideration that this was when the fugitives, I'll say fugitive, but they weren't, fugitives, sitting and eating in Judge Martin's inn. He said, nah, they're not here.
Wow.
Delamore says Judge Martin actually provided the tar and feathers so local citizens could appropriately deal with the bounty hunters. If it isn't obvious yet, Delamore loves her place. She came from her hometown of Philadelphia in 1972 and never went back. That love shows throughout our day together. While it's called a tour of African American history with a focus on the Underground Railroad, it often morphed into a tour of Olean history and Delamore's engaging personal history. She points to a tile mural that stands at the corner of State and Union Streets that depicts the history of Olean.
So it's cool. And now let me see if I can do this.
Okay.
All right. We have a mural.
Yeah.
The tile is from the Olean tile plant, which is no longer in existence. We have the river, which is right, you know, the strips going down is the river.
Gotcha.
It's Allegheny River. And we have the Native Americans who, you know, beautiful, been here and have done so much and has so much history in itself. We have the people who came, represented by the two pilgrims there. And we have the tree, which is the lumber, which is a very important part of the Olean history. And we have the factory, which is industry. This guy loves me. Sorry about that. Industry, and we have the school, which is education, and we have oil, which is, and I wish I had my pointer so I can point to them, but it's quite a mural.
It is.
A mural in the city history. This is Manufacture Hanover. It was First National Bank. It was my bank when I first came here in 72.
Okay. This is at the corner of North Union and State Street,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay. Yep. And for a long time, it was, you know, questionable whether we could save it or not. And thank God, it is now safe. We have people living there. We have a venue for art exhibits and everything right in there. It has one of those like in the Westerns, they have this big vault.
Yes.
It's got it in there. I love it. 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 Yeah. And the marble and the iron. Yes. It's awesome.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful building.
Yes, it is.
They saved it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, they did. Man. Yes, they did. I thank God for it. Okay. So we can
lead away.
Yes. Well, this is Lincoln Park.
Yep.
Which has a story of its own.
Oh.
And they're supposed to stop.
Are they going to let us do it?
Yeah, stop. All right. You stop.
Oh, look at this. And someone else is being nice enough to stop here, too. Wow.
There are several street crossings during the tour, all led safely by Della Moore, who never misses a chance to wave to passersby who almost always wave back.
Lot of editing.
Oh, that's all right.
Going off the wall and stuff.
But sorry. It gives me a chance to listen to you again, so I like editing.
Okay,
yeah.
Olean underwent a major change for its downtown in recent years, slowing traffic on Union Street, making the busy state route more narrow, and by adding roundabouts. It's all work to make for a more attractive setting.
And these are one of the benches I was telling you about.
Oh, yeah.
I come down here sometime at night, and there are people sitting and just having a cup of coffee or one or two, you know, just sitting having.
Well, look
I
at
love
this beautiful
it.
Garden here.
Yes,
amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's another thing. Wow, we got people who take care of their this beautiful. I couldn't do it.
No.
Oh, God. I don't have a green. I kill cactus.
I kill weeds. And I don't do that well either.
Yeah, yes. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry I didn't mention
no,
that.
No, but
yeah,
it just adds the whole.
Look at it.
Yeah.
Oh, Dallas, you got to take a picture of this. I mean, look at that. I mean, awesome.
And while we are attentive with all of our street crossings, an email grabs Della's attention. She asks me to read it.
Oh, God bless you.
The African American Center for Cultural Development is hosting a Juneteenth celebration at Bethany Lutheran Church and Leo Moss Drive in Olean on Saturday, June 29th, noon to 3. Everybody welcome?
Yes. Absolutely.
And you'll be
if
there?
If you don't come, yes, absolutely.
If you're there,
yes,
a lot of
absolutely.
People are going to come.
I hope so.
And you told, before you told me about the food that might be there, what are you promising?
Well, I'm telling you, hot dogs, hamburgers, pulled pork sandwiches, and barbecue ribs.
Oh. You better make a lot.
Yeah.
I think our whole listening audience
might be
there.
Last time we sold out.
I bet you did.
Yeah. Now that we have our own kitchen, we can make more. Yeah.
Oh, you're making that right at your industrial kitchen?
At the center. And then, because we had to be there a certain time because you had to start that, like, 6 o'clock in the morning,
yes.
You know, smoking and all that good stuff. So, and that was too much for my sister to go over there and then keep going back and forth and stuff.
Are you suggesting that this is a family recipe for ribs that we're going to be treated to?
Oh, absolutely. 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 Without a doubt. We sold out last year. So she's going to make more. She's going to make more this year. Absolutely.
Wow.
Oh, man. I'll try to save you. I'll save
you. You don't have to save me. You have to save yourself from the crowd.
I didn't get any.
No?
No, last year. No. No, I didn't. Yeah, she was, she sold out.
Okay.
So, okay, let me just send
you
and
do what
tell
you gotta
her
do.
That it's okay. I love it. There you go. Yes, there you go. Okay. Hi, guys.
Hi, good morning.
All right. You guys holding up?
I'm doing all right. We almost lost Dallas. But like I said, he's a former college track star. He'll catch us.
No problem.
He'll catch me, that's for sure.
No,
maybe not you.
No, he's out. Oh, this is the Allegheny River.
Yep, the mighty Allegheny.
Yes, and what it is the I-86 of the 1800s, you know? Because, you know, this is the highway that people rolled down the logging. People used it, the runaway enslaved people used it, you know, to come to travel, you know? So this is it. And we got a guide. Oh, at one time, it was all the way up here.
Oh, the river
used to
be up here?
Oh, yeah,
that's
right. Believe it, yes.
Around.
Well, we had the flood of 72 Agnes.
Agnes, yep.
Yes, and it came all the way up here. And then we built the dikes up higher and all. And so.
And it's a beautiful view. Look
at
the mountains,
though?
The way it winds through.
Yes, yes,
wow.
Yeah. Awesome. That's
at this
awesome.
Point of what's next, we're about an hour into our tour with Della Moore of Olean's African American Center for Cultural Development. We make our way west of Union Street into an older neighborhood. We see the home of Catherine Kenny, who for many years was the only African-American teacher in Olean. Then, a stop at the former site of the historically significant Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in Olean.
Oh, Okay, this used to be the parsonage for the church.
Okay.
And that's the church right there.
Ah. Huh.
And this is at the corner of what, West Green and South 3rd Street?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And that was this is the church that I was, that when I came here, that was my first church, 72.
Okay.
And, we had nice things here. We had, picnics, field trips, a booming Sunday school, and the church was always packed.
And what was the name of the church again?
Bethel AME Church. Yes.
How you doing?
How you doing? Mm-hmm. Real good. Yeah, Bethel AME Church. Right now it's Epic Church, part of Epic Church. And, this was where we had our first Juneteenth and our grand opening of the center.
Oh, right over here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yes,
this is historic.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This has a history of its own. It it was on Fifth Street, and the church burned down, and then it was on another street, I think it's 7th or somewhere down, and then it burned down there.
Hmm.
So then they built it here, and every people of all races were here to help build it.
All right.
And this is where it stayed, have been ever since.
But it was here when you arrived
in 72 it was, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was.
So tell me about the congregation.
Congregation was full of beautiful music and all. And Catherine Kenny and her family was instrumental in helping build up this church. I mean, congregational wise, our organist, Lois Easley, lived across the street. She was an important member of this church. Her sons, Tim Spiller, lived down the street, and he was also an important member of the church community. And I can see right now the kids sitting on the steps waiting for the bus to take them somewhere, for a trip, field trip and stuff. And it was nice. And it was nice.
When you got here, was that also kind of like your introduction into the history about Olean as well, and understanding, getting a sense of, where this was on the Underground Railroad?
Oh, no. When I got here, when I got here, I was interested in all Olean history.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Was this where you started
learning about it?
No. This is, it wasn't.
Okay.
It was it was part of it. But and a part that is really close to my heart, because that's the religion and stuff. But as I had learned about it, my interest was piqued seemingly as soon as I hit these shores. It was piqued, because I've always been interested in Black history, not regular history, because regular history, social studies, they didn't speak to me. They didn't, because hardly anybody I knew that looked like me represented in the books that they taught us from, except for slaves. And they didn't do it in such a positive light like I imparted to you.
We didn't hear about
you.
Sarah Johnson.
Yeah, right. George Washington Carver. Yeah, and that was wonderful and marvelous and all. But it wasn't. You picture a Black kid in a big classroom with many other races other than herself, and all you had to your credit was people who were slaved and whipped down and stuff like that. They didn't speak about the resilience. They didn't speak about the brave person, even a child. They didn't speak about it like that. Not to my knowledge, no. So it didn't, history was, okay, all right, okay. I learned a lot about other races, but I didn't learn about myself. My history, learning of my history came from my family.
Yeah, your parents were instrumental in that?
Mm-hmm. Parents, sisters, and aunts, yes, yeah, yeah, yes.
Can you remember when you were younger, Maybe.
Oh, I can remember. Not that long ago. Come on.
But I'm talking about a story, though,
I know, I hear you.
When you were young, mm-hmm. that made you realize just what you just were talking about. The idea that mm-hmm. you were in a classroom mm-hmm. and the only thing that you saw about people mm-hmm. of color were mm-hmm. the fact that they had been enslaved and pushed down. Was there a moment or a story that you remember hearing that kind of changed that perspective for you and that you started understanding a different way of looking at mm-hmm. history?
I would think it was when you told me in the classroom or
no,
out?
Well, okay. Wherever it happened, out. Whether okay. it was at your family's house, at church, wherever right. it happened. So can you remember something like that?
Well, often my parents, my mother and my sisters and my aunt would let us know that we were important. And our whole neighborhood was awesome. I mean, just the whole neighborhood was that. And it was mostly black. I think we had one white family on it in our block, and one white family owned the grocery store in the end of the block. But it was just awesome. And we felt so good, you know, about that. And so so valued, you know. And our parents, it wasn't that they coddled us, because, I mean, if you did anything incorrectly around the outside of the neighborhood, you talk about network system now. Our parents knew about it before we got home. Not that I did. I'm going, right. No, not me.
Yeah.
Those other guys. Yeah,
right.
But I tell you, when I think about the telling of black history, I remember sitting on the floor around with a couple of my siblings. My aunt Gladys, you know about Langston Hughes,
yes,
and
they,
okay, yes, uh-huh. Well, and Paul Laurence Dunbar with the dialogue and everything. She would recite some beautiful things on Paul Laurence Dunbar and Langston Hughes, and it just lift your heart right up. And you recognize that, and yeah, and I remember that. Yeah, that's what I try to show people, how to pass things on. You know, we have to pass it on. Yeah, you don't want to be lost. Like I say, that if you don't know your history, now I'm situating myself. Okay, yes. I hope you're ready. No, that's okay. You don't know your history. You're like this. There's a tree. You're the tree, and there are no roots. And what can you relate to? You know, you got to know your history. You got to know that this is not just a church. This is not just a building. There has a history to the building, you know? That I'm not just a person, a little old lady with gray hair walking down the street. I have a history. And my photographer, Dallas, he has a history, you know? And you have to know that. And once you do that, you treat people differently. You do. But a little value and respect. You know,
I understand that totally. And I'm going to ask you this question.
Well, come on, take it apart. Come
it's
on,
a little
come
tougher on. Question, I think, okay. But I want to see what do you think about this. Like you said, you have to know your roots. I like that idea. Please. But at the same time, like you said, when you were young mm-hmm. and you were in school, mm-hmm. that wasn't the history you knew. Do you think that many people of color have been deprived of those roots and that history just for that very reason?
Lots that I've spoken to, yes. Yeah, yes. And it's unfortunate. There was a point that it seems to be going now, that there was black history, but I don't hear very much of that anymore. And that's sad. That's sad. And it's like, oh, if I can be not disrespectful, but if I can be bring it to a certain a different level, it's like the cursive that used to be over the blackboard, they've taken that down. How are we going to learn how to write? You know, I mean, what I used to be a cashier for most of my life. Yeah, longer than I lived, yeah. And I taught my cashiers to count their change back. That's a lost art, you know? I know this is kind of far-fetched, but if we don't keep teaching people these rudimentary things, it's going to be a lost art. I mean, I still don't feel comfortable when somebody gives me my change bundled up in it with the receipt and just hand it to me like that. I still don't feel comfortable about that. So, and it's a lost art. And my sister told me one time, said, but they don't know, and that killed me. That crushed my spirit when they said, she said, they don't know. I said, well, somebody should teach them, you know. So, okay.
Does it make you feel better about me to know that I was a cashier and I always counted my change back to my customers?
Nothing in this world could make me not love you more. And then, well, I'm trying to get it together now. And that you just okay, yeah, that's I can see the crown now. Okay, there you go. I wondered why I loved you so much. Yeah. Oh, please, yes. I would ask them, please put your change away first, and they put your change away in the crown. Yeah, people still remember that, but now they don't do that anymore. Okay. No, I'll get off that.
But that's all right. To Black History, then. Let's stay on that for just a second. As long as you want, we could stand here in this corner and talk about it all you want. Let's go back to the rudiment fundamentals of Black History that you believe people need to know. Mm-hmm. What stands out to you?
Well, that Black people have been inventors before the term was invented. Oh, that was a terrible thing, the English, but you know what I mean, right? They've been business people. They've had their wealth before Wall Street was even thought about. They've had, there's a thing, anniversary coming up, it's past June 1st, 1921, Tulsa. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Need I say more? And then we had millionaires, you know, and before, and people have to know about that. And most of all, people have to know in their own family who is should be the hero, you know, really, really. And I'm talking about, ask your parents, your grandparents, hey, what was happening in your life, and stuff like that. And ask them by looking straight in their eyes and attention, not like this. Yeah, Mom, what was it? And what'd you say, Mom? No, please, that's what I'm trying to teach the people around, you know, that I come in contact with when we have our classes and stuff like that. Absolutely. Because you can't, something happens when you ask somebody something and your attention is not there. And they know when your attention is there or not. They know. So if something happened, they draw back. And there you lost that opportunity, you know, really. And so many grandfathers that have gone and grandmothers that have gone and will never know the ordinary thing of their life. And I feel terrible because I feel awful because my kids have given me a book saying all of that. It's called All About Me. And I'm supposed to be writing since last year. I'm supposed to be writing everything, you know, from my childhood up. And I got to get to that. Hey, bud, how you doing? All right. Love you too. Thank you. So, and I got to get to it because I want them to have that. Sure. You know, I want them to have it.
Well, you got a few things on your plate that keep you busy. These days,
just
right?
A couple.
All right. So we'll give you a break for now.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I hope they get a part of this so they'll see it. Somebody gave me a break, you guys.
Oh yeah. It's nice.
Yeah. Nice. But yeah, that's what it's all about. You know, that I had a friend that I didn't know as a friend until I got to know you as a friend. And I've only palled around a couple times, and then he passed away. I mean, and his obituary was like almost two columns long, and I never knew any of that about him. And I said, no, that's not supposed to happen. That's not his Black man. I said, that's not supposed to happen. No. And not in my shift. And so that's, I keep pushing. Okay. I keep pushing, yeah. And I remember, I don't know if I told you, but when I used to, when I taught, my final was that, when I, the first day of class, we put names in a hat of what, of all the people that we were going to teach. I mean, they were going to learn, right? And so, and then people would take out the names of the people, and like Sojourner Truth, Fannie Lou Hamer, and the rest, and they, and their assignment was to, while they're learning, because I would be teaching them, but they would do some work on their own and learn as much as they can about them, and then at the end we would have a meeting of the mind, press conference. And those people will be up there. And so I would only pick a few, you know. I couldn't pick everybody. But the other people will be the audience.
All right.
And what happens is the people who are will be up on the stage will be graded with their knowledge. And audience will be graded with what the questions they ask to show their knowledge. So, yeah. So it's a win-win situation. All right. But that was the final. That was the final. Yes. Yeah. We had some pretty good times, too. Yeah. They're pretty good times, but that's teaching without teaching.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. That's my philosophy.
I like it. I like it. I like your philosophy.
Okay. Yep. All right. So let's go. All right. We go.
So which part of the tour do you say, would you guess, gets, I don't know, the most attention? I don't know if that's the word I'm looking for, but the one spot along the tour that seems to generate the most conversation or gets the greatest reaction. Do you have a spot along here that seems to do that?
Yeah, there are a couple. Yeah. There one, of course, Sarah Johnson and the Olean House.
Yep.
And then you, there's a little bit of the Russell Sin.
Okay.
And Bethlehem Church. And of course, Sarah Johnson's house.
Ah.
Yeah. And one more. It would be Oak Hill Park, which used to be a cemetery.
Oh, okay.
And he was like, what? Oh, yeah, it used to be a cemetery.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so I'll tell you all about that in a minute.
All right.
But there's Sarah Johnson's house, the one wrapped up.
Okay,
yeah.
Getting a little rehab right
okay.
now.
Okay. She was deeded this house in 1850 when the fugitive slave laws had teeth in it. By teeth, I mean that when, if you helped a runaway slave or knew of somebody else who was helping the runaway person, be careful.
Mm-hmm.
You are in danger of a fine, like $1,000, and $1,000 is a lot of money in those days, or your place being, oh, we can walk up here.
Okay.
Your place being taken away,
mm-hmm.
or jail.
Okay.
Yes. They tried to make it very, very hard for, you know, people who were aiding the people who were running away, you know. Yes. And so there it is. There's Sarah Johnson's house.
So by deeding her this house, basically mm-hmm. it made it impossible for the bounty hunters to take her away? Is that,
oh, no.
No?
No, 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 no.
There's
no.
still a threat?
That means, yeah, no, there was still a threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as I said, sometimes when you walk the street, when you're walking, you have a black person walking on the street, they could scoop that person up and sell them back to the people down south or who paid them. Yeah, there was nothing stopping them except the townspeople.
And this town
yes.
came through?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Big time. Big time, yes.
One legend surrounding Sarah Johnson was that she would spend nights looking out her window to the south, watching the Allegheny River, looking for other formerly enslaved people trying to make their way to freedom. The housing stock in this part of Olean is particularly old. While some homes hold considerable charm, others are in dire need of repair.
Or they're blown.
Yes, was a neighbor there that... nice person, but she had the Confederate flag out there. So we, one of the gentlemen around me said, "Listen, I'll buy you." It was really tattered and torn, and so he said, I'll buy you another. I'll buy you an American flag if you give it to that. So, and she, I don't know what happened, but yeah, she did. You did. Yeah, I got you.
It sounds like a yes. They should have taken advantage of that offer, I think.
I think they did.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I haven't been high. I'm not sure if I haven't been around in a while.
Sure.
So yeah. Yes. Yeah. So yeah.
Della tells me Sarah Johnson left Olean late in her life to be with her daughter in Kane, Pennsylvania. Upon her death, she was brought back to Olean for what is said to be the largest funeral in the history of the AME Church. She's said to be buried in the nearby town of Allegheny, but the grave's whereabouts stands as a mystery of history.
All right, so we're at that, so we're at the corner of that State Street?
Yes.
And Fifth Street, okay.
All right. This is where I lose most of my people.
Oh.
Because that hill is steeper than you think.
All right.
Especially after walking almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I understand. If we want to go around, we can go around. All right. You ready?
It sounded like you were challenging me. Dallas, you're up to the challenge? Dallas is up to the challenge.
Okay.
You're up to the challenge.
Yeah, I'm up there. Okay.
We'll find out if I'm up to the challenge.
we'll take our time.
Oh, yeah, that's
all
good.
We're headed for Oak Hill Park.
Oh, I got to go to this place.
The,
yeah.
Yeah, which is the cemetery I told
yep.
you about.
Yep.
And, yeah. Which is an underground railroad station.
Mm.
Yes.
It is a steep climb to Oak Hill Park, but proves to be well worth it. Just like so much of our tour with Della Moore, every corner seems to hold another new understanding of a history that may have been more buried than forgotten.
And we've gone upstairs.
Up the stairs, okay.
She also tells of other underground railroad stations in Cattaraugus County, places like Ishawa and Katy's that were a familiar part of my youth, yet their connection to the path to freedom was never told.
Yes. Okay, now this is Oak Hill Park, and this is where it was a cemetery, and picture without all the wood, the fences, and the benches, et cetera. This is, it was trees and all, and they moved the graves, and they made it a park. Yes. And you see people, and we have a playhouse. Right there is where they, I'm sorry, keep on beating. And we have play in the park.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shakespeare in the park, play in the park, and tennis, and playground for kids, and puppies.
Yes.
Dogs. Trying to get my sister to let me have her dog so I can bring them up. yeah.
You bring them up here, they'll love you forever.
Oh, yes. That's what I try to tell them. Yes.
I'm getting a sense of how far we walk when I look over and I see the bank building now, right?
That's
the
yes.
back of
yeah.
the bank building.
Yeah, that's it.
Over at the corner of State
yes.
and Union. Yeah,
uh-huh.
all right. Wow,
yep.
we're a good distance away.
Yes,
you're
yes,
taking
yes,
me
yeah.
on a long journey.
oh, God is good. Yes. Yeah, this whole thing used to be a station. Was used as a station.
Yeah. But it was a cemetery at the time.
Yeah, cemetery, yes. Yes. Whoa.
There we go. That feels Ooh. That doesn't feel too bad
Take
now,
a load
does it?
Off.
Huh? No, absolutely.
oh my gosh.
It's nice to sit uh-huh. down.
Wow, nice. Oh wow.
So this is called Oak Hill Park.
Yes, Oak Hill Park. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Huge, huge oak trees.
Oh here. My gosh. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yes.
The mountains out in the background.
Oh yeah. Photographer's dream, Dallas. Photographer's dream. yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes.
And I got a feeling after 2 hours of walking, most of your tours, they're probably glad to be in this place.
yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. They are, yeah. If they make it this far.
Yeah.
No, I mean... Not in a wrong way, because I mean that's
hill.
2 hours.
That hill
is yes,
it's like the Boston Marathon.
yeah, yes, it doesn't look like it. If you fresh start out, it doesn't look oh that. But you travel for 2 hours and then walk up it. Yeah, I didn't plan it that way. It's the way it was.
It lays out.
It lays out.
Way.
Yes,
yeah.
It certainly does. Mm. Yes, yes.
Well, it's
torturing them up the hill and stuff like that.
It's a beautiful tour.
Oh,
I really
thank you,
Delamore,
very much.
I so much appreciate bringing Dallas Taylor and I along for the walk today.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you very much. I had a ball, and I hope, you know, I didn't strain everything because, you know, you held up well.
The biggest surprise of the day.
No, it was not. No. The biggest surprise is me. That's the biggest surprise. I was going on faith. Every step was faith because I've been having problems with that. But I can't let that stop me.
Right.
Yeah, just as long as he says that if you take the first step, he'll be there for the rest of it, and he's there.
That concludes our walking tour of the African American history of Olean with myself, digital editor Dallas Taylor, and Della Moore, founder of the African American Center for Cultural Development. Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Join WBFO every Saturday at 6 p.m. for an insightful and enlightening series of audio documentaries from our region that tackle topics such as the environment, health, the world of entertainment, and more. Listen to the WBFO DocuHour every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WBFO, your NPR station.
Discover the intersection of musical expression and emotional introspection. Listen to Mindful Music, hosted by mental health care worker Carl Shallowhorn. Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. on WBFO.
Hey people, Corey here with Compaq Civics. One of my favorite days is Election Day. It's my civic duty, and yours, to cast a ballot. I mean, people fought and died so we could vote. Yet nearly 60 years after the Voting Rights Act of 1965, there are still efforts to strip Americans of that right, which often leads to serious disenfranchisement. Let's dig into it. Federal law mandates accessible polling places for those living with a disability, but nationwide, compliance is inconsistent. Know your rights. In New York State, any voter who seeks assistance is entitled to receive it regardless of the reason. About 4 million people living in the U.S. territories, Guam, the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, are all U.S. citizens, but they can't vote in the presidential election. 11 states disenfranchise individuals convicted of felonies, even after they paid their debt to society. Even accusations of misdemeanors can lead to temporary disenfranchisement. In many states, individuals in jail, even if it's just because they can't afford to post bail, cannot vote during elections. In a democracy, all citizens' voices deserve to be heard, and that means casting and counting their votes as well.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
For this segment of What's Next, we speak with Marquise Burton, known best as 10,000. He calls himself a freestyle poet, and later in our conversation, we will take him up on his offer to create a freestyle poem on the spot. But first, there are a few subjects to discuss with Marquise Burton. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Hey, thanks for coming in. 10,000 is a poet. He has been a poet now. This is year 20 for you.
Yep, year 20.
Right here in the Buffalo area, you've been making your way on poetry.
Yeah, well, in the limit, figuring out where it fits, trying it with different artistries, yep.
How did it start for you?
So it started for me back when I was, I believe, 13, going on 14. We moved from the inner city out to Amherst, and that culture change was a real shock. Going from a community where everywhere I navigated, I saw people that looked like me, moving to a community where I saw a lot less. So the idea of actually visually seeing myself as a minority made a shift in me. And then the year prior to that, my grandmother passed away, my mom's mom, and she was like that second mother to us. So that emotional change with that culture change combined let me realize that basketball and being physical wasn't enough. I needed a way to figure out my emotions. So the first poem I wrote in the cafetorium was of Sweet Home Middle School was Outkast.
Outkast. So if you don't mind, can we just talk about that culture change? Again, it was 20 years ago. I'm not sure how much different it would be for a 13-year-old today to move from the inner city to Sweet Home. I won't even take a guess at how that might be. But what was it like 20 years ago to go through that culture change?
I think 20 years ago, going through that culture change was definitely a shock, because you're so used to being in a neighborhood. I think more even in the school was more of like, okay, it was a shock when you got into the classrooms and saw it, because the few kids of color and black kids that were in those spaces, we hung out and engaged with each other. So it felt okay. But especially in your neighborhood was the biggest shock, because you look around and you don't see people that look like you. And then some people in that community may not interact with you well based off of whatever stereotypes they've developed through the media and their own small, you know, interactions in life. So being the odd person out and seeing that and experiencing that, it makes you wonder, like, makes you feel uneasy a little bit.
Sure.
Like that.
How about the influence of the inner city? So you spent your formative years on the east side of Buffalo. Do you feel like that's something that has led you to be the artist that you are now?
100%.
Yeah?
I feel like the east side of Buffalo taught me how to engage, have a sense of community, the desire to always want to give back, and overall to be present, to have a sense of faith and hopefulness and wanting something more, and always the willingness to show up for your community and the people you love.
Is that what you've seen from the East Side community in the last 2 years since, May 14th, 2022? I've heard people say that when you say, talking about showing up, that's something that I've heard a lot from folks.
I think that's been the case not only 2 years ago, but pretty much since I was born into that and navigated throughout that. And I've seen people left and right show up. So when other parts of the city or whatever has failed us, we have showed up for each other.
Where do you live now?
I live on the east side.
You live on the east side? Yeah. What do you like about it?
The one thing, how can I put it? The things I like about it overall is seeing the people that look like me.
Yeah, yeah.
Seeing the people engage, see the way we navigate, be creative and figure it out. The ability to find joy even in the chaos. Still be our authentic self the best way we know how, and be welcomed in those spaces. And then also, I think the good thing I see, but also the sad part I see, is that there are changes going on that should have been done decades before, but you know they're only occurring because they're planning to shift the overall culture and navigating of that neighborhood. And they're only making these changes to benefit who will possibly come to the neighborhood instead of the people that have already been in the neighborhood and a part of the good, bad, and ugly of the neighborhood.
So I'm going to read into your words just a little bit. When you were talking about some of these major plans that are being discussed for the East Side, whether it's the change of the Kensington Expressway or perhaps the remaking of the Central Terminal, things along those lines is what you're suggesting.
Yeah, and even just like repaving the roads or building out the sidewalks that have been messed up, or because I stay more in the Cold Spring area, how they're building up this medical corridor and they're building up all these new apartments and everything else and increasing the overall value of a neighborhood that once before was difficult to either sell a house through that neighborhood or even just comfortably live in the neighborhood.
I'm interested to hear that you're taking me in this conversation into some really interesting places, and I'm interested to hear your perspective. So, I mean, you see that the idea that these improvements are coming, but they're not necessarily for the people who are there right now. Is that the way you would sum that up?
I would say yes in certain ways, because we've seen that on a national scale.
Right.
We've seen different communities around the country where they made changes, made innovation, and either, the value increases, it prices people out, people are not homeowners, the rent goes up, so people are priced out of their home it's their home. They may have paid rent for 20 years, but it's their home.
Right.
And they make these changes to the neighborhood and beautify them, and it does a disservice sometimes.
Right.
So
do you sense though the community perhaps kind of like you, I mean, everybody, they see it coming. And is there a sense of people trying to do something to stop kind of what we're talking about here? Or is it I don't want to say accepting what's going to happen, but just maybe the forces that are pushing this are going to be too powerful to stop?
I say it doesn't need to be overall like hindered, because at the end of the day, we still want those neighborhoods to be better.
Right.
We still want, you know, those roads, those sidewalks, just those overall, you know, cleaning out, cutting out, you know, open field grass. There's certain things that we do and other communities do all the time to make that neighborhood comfortable for the people that currently live there. Like, they still want those changes to occur.
Right.
Because a lot of these changes have been voiced over and over and over again. And I feel like it is meant for the ones that are there. But we know through time, we've seen that with multiple neighborhoods, where through time, as beautify comes through, it grows and all that, you have landlords raising rent, you have things shifting and changing in a way that sometimes doesn't benefit the ones who are currently here.
Right, right. Very good. Another thing, you talked about how members of the Eastside community have learned to, you know, find a way to get things done, to you know, whether it's survive or thrive, or, you know, that kind of a creative sense that comes from that. Can you explore that a little bit, how you see it, and maybe how you, you know, it influences your work as well? I mean, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So it influences my work the best way is like, I've always had a sense of giving back. Is it training the next set of poets who want to slam? If it's going to a community center, doing work with the youth, or doing work with older adults, and just creating the idea of giving back. I've always taught that you didn't get here alone, so you make sure you pave a way so other people can get to other parts, you know, don't have to struggle as hard as you do. So if it's teaching people how to regulate themselves by writing better, is it helping with public speaking? Is it just laughing and joking? Is it just being present in spaces sometimes? I've always been taught that you show up, you be present, and you show up and you be present, and that's how you care. You may not even have a dime to give, but you have your presence to give.
What about the poetry and, like you said, the kind of the work that you're doing? Are you seeing more people getting attracted to that? You know, you can think back to where you were 20 years ago before you started, and like you said, you were writing, you didn't even know you were doing mm-hmm. poetry. Do you find people are finding maybe that that is an outlet that they're pursuing, and maybe it's becoming a little more sought after?
I think it is, because you have amazing it's like when I was about 17, I went to this coffee shop over on Oak Grove called Empty Cup Cafe.
Okay.
And over there, they had an open mic every Tuesday night. And for me, that was my golden age of poetry here in Buffalo, because you had heavy hitters. You had Archie the Messenger. You had Q Boogie. You had James Cooper III, who was the host of it. And you had every Tuesday, no matter what, doesn't matter if it was 90 degrees, below zero, we would be there spitting poetry. And it was that energy and that synergy of the community. And that was in the heart of the East Side. But now, fast forward, we have different open mics, Wordism, open mic at Cafe Aroma, all these different sectors of having at least 30 to 40 people packed out at their open mics, and open mics throughout the city. So I feel like poetry is coming around, especially with all the conflict in our society, politics, and everything else. I've realized that I've seen enough time that poetry, you know, really shines the lens on what's going on globally, locally, and nationally, and allows people to express their ways in a very creative way.
On this segment of What's Next, you're listening to Marquise Burton, the poet best known as 10,000. During our recording, he was gracious enough to offer creating a freestyle poem on any topic of our choice. The choice, in recognition of this week, was Juneteenth in Buffalo.
Every time of the year, you could feel it in the air. It is its own form. You could feel it in the air. You could feel it in the air. You could feel it in the air. You could feel when the community comes together and it's a rock in a wave. It is no nay nay. It's just here. It is a feeling that lives with us. You can almost smell and hear and taste freedom, what it means to come together. When people from around the country say what Juneteenth was, I say Juneteenth has been in my blood since I've been birthed in this beautiful city. We have always celebrated our freedom, always loved what it means to be black and beautiful in the city that sometimes wants to discard us. I still remember from the earliest age of walking through this festivities, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the way community lived and vibed inside of this. Juneteenth has always been a pillar in this city, has always been something to capture and see family members you haven't seen for decades, seeing loved ones that come into town and go there before they visit your home. It is its own family. It's buried in the parades and the celebrations, a massive block party of blackness that makes us feel loved and appreciated. We learn how to cultivate in our spaces. Can't you smell all the shea butter, all the creativity that lives here, all the marching and belief, all the belief that doesn't deter, how we love ourselves and love to uplift who we are, even when the city doesn't seem to love us back. We learn how to love each other out loud, to find the joy inside this beautiful representation of our liberation. We scream it loud and proud. Don't matter if it took decades for it to be a national holiday and how other people try to take it and raise profits and funds for themselves. We gonna still celebrate. We gonna still uplift. We gonna be a roar, tumble, and a celebration. We gonna be larger, prouder, and more rock raving what we are. We found our, we live in our blackness day in, day out. But this weekend and those days, we gonna celebrate. We gonna let the world know that nothing can stop us, and we gonna stay alive. We gonna march ahead. We gonna force change and believe change exists inside a community. It's a celebration of that we are still here. We lost many loved ones, but we are still gonna celebrate, still find the gospel and the holiness and spirituality and what it means to be uplifting, to see the beauty of each other. Don't let the city question what it is, because sometimes it feel like they don't love us. So we gonna love each other back and forth. We gonna be the liberation. We gonna be the voice. We gonna be loud and proud and let you know that our blackness don't reside in a month, don't reside in just today's. We gonna carry Juneteenth each and every day, but these days we gonna show you what it means to be black and proud, how we push against oppression and see the beauty of what it means when we believe, and when we believe, when we believe in each other. Can you hear the rumbling of one voice, of one heartbeat, of one lung increasing and pushing out? Do you know what it means when we speak loud and proud? It is Juneteenth. Don't matter if they try to market and slap it on a great value at Walmart shelf, we will still realize that Juneteenth ain't meant supposed to be shelved, supposed to be loud, supposed to be giving, supposed to understand that we are a revolution. We are revolutionary, that we are living in a time and times before that we will speak up for all the pillars, all the ones that laid the groundwork, and we will lay the groundwork for the future. So yeah, happy Juneteenth. We gonna let them know that it is meant to be celebrated more than just a government decides to recognize us, because we know as fast as they recognize us, they will dehuman us. So we will celebrate in our own record. So happy Juneteenth.
Wow, that is really amazing. It, you know, and just one other comment before we go, and maybe you've heard this from other people, it almost seems like a spirit's coming inside you when you go into your freestyle. Yeah. You sense that?
Yeah, what I tell people is like, it's that moment where, it's that one spot in my life where everything feels weightless. As I call it, me and just me and God, me and the universe. And it's just that moment where it's just we connecting. And then whatever is received to me, I'm spitting out and processing and living, and I'm just moving around it. And I can't have anything in a way. So if I try to force it or try to have organized thoughts without it, it goes south. So I'll just try to lead it. And then when I feel like, okay, I can stop it or cut the flow, I'll cut it and end it.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing with us today.
Thank you.
It's been great. Marquise Burton, 10,000. You can find him on Instagram at 10,000 Poetry. You also have a website, right?
Yep.
Was it 10,000?
10,000poetry.com.
10,000poetry.com. Marquise, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.